Okay, so 6 o'clock in Israel. Welcome, everybody. Might as well get started. I know other people are still joining us, but I always like to reward those people who have come in on time. And so we will get started. So first of all, it's great to be back. We were off for 2 weeks because I was in the United States. I had a wonderful trip, and two of the people that I saw on my trip are now with us on the Zoom, Jim and Richard. So that's really fun. Anyway, we are back to Joshua. I have one small comment that I want to make to finish off chapter one, but most of what we're doing today will be chapter two. So what we did in chapter one, a lot of what we did was showing the way the book of Joshua is actually a direct connection to the five books of Moses, to the book of Deuteronomy, and how the wording and some of the themes and some of the wording is mentioned in such a way so that we see that connection, particularly everything having to do with Joshua being the heir of Moses in the leadership of the nation. One thing that we kind of glossed over briefly, but I want to just focus on that a bit, is the words be strong and courageous. And we did note that in this first chapter, the words be strong and courageous are mentioned four times. Okay? Three times, God says directly to Joshua, be strong and courageous. And in addition, at the end of the chapter, when there's this interchange between the 2.5 tribes that are staying east of the Jordan, the Reuben, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, in their interchange with Joshua, the final words that they say to him is only be strong and courageous. And actually, this parallels the same very similar words that are said to or about Joshua in the Torah, in the previous book. So first of all, in Deuteronomy 1, Moses says to the nation, he talks about Deuteronomy 1:38. He talks to the nation about the appointment of Joshua as his heir, and he says to them, you should strengthen him. Okay. And then God says to Moses in Deuteronomy 3, he says, he's reminding him of the appointment of Joshua. And he says to Moses, you need to strengthen, he says, Chatzeo b'amtzeo, you should give him strength and courage. Okay. So basically, God is saying to Moses, you need to say to Joshua, be strong and have courage. So we have the first one, we have Moses saying to the nation, you, the nation, need to say to Joshua, be strong and have courage. And then we have God saying to Moses, Moses, you say to Joshua, be strong and have courage. And finally, at the very end of of Deuteronomy, in Deuteronomy 31, Moses, in fact, appoints Joshua finally to the position, and he says to them, to him, be strong and courageous. So what we essentially have then is at the end of Deuteronomy, when Moses says to Joshua, be strong and courageous, he is fulfilling God's commandment to him in Deuteronomy 1. But in Deuteronomy 30, in Deuteronomy 3, Moses tells the nation to strengthen Joshua, and we see that taking place in the interchange between the 2.5 tribes and Joshua, where at the end they say to Joshua, be strong and courageous. The first three times in chapter one, though, is God saying this directly to Moses. And I think that's like amazing because basically we've engineered a situation, God has engineered a situation where he is going to say to Moses directly, he says to Moses, excuse me, he is going to say to Joshua directly, be strong, courageous. And he says it three times. So it's really powerful. He says to Moses, you make sure to tell Joshua, be strong, courageous before you die when you appointment. And he does. And then Moses tells the nation, you have to tell also Joshua, be strong, courageous. And that we have at the end of chapter one. And so there's this real, I would look at it as like a blanket of protection and support that Joshua receives. He has this direct appointment from God. He has the support of the nation of Israel, and he has the support from his predecessor, from Moses, all of them saying, you need to be strong and courageous. So, I find this, the way this is used in chapter one, to really be very significant and meaningful in this way as Joshua goes forward and becomes the leader of the nation. Okay, that's the end of chapter one. Now we go to chapter two. Now I have to tell you, for me, chapter two is one of my favorite chapters in Joshua, probably is my favorite chapter in Joshua. It is probably my one of my favorite chapters in the entire Bible. Okay, I just think it's amazing. So now we're going to take it apart and see what it's all about. So let's start reading Joshua chapter 2. Joshua the son of Nun secretly sent two spies from the Shittim, telling them, go check out the land. Check out the land and Jericho. And they went and they came to the house of a prostitute, and her name is Rahab, and they stayed there. Okay, so let's just look at this first chapter. Of course, we all know the story. Okay, but what I want to do now is delve a little deeper. Let's pay attention to some of the words, some of the hints, some of the ideas that just some of the words in this first chapter are telling us. Okay, now, if we talked about earlier the relationship between chapter one and the five books of Moses, here we are also going to see a lot of connection. None of these words are by accident. So the first thing we find out is that Joshua is sending these spies from the Shittim. Okay, the Shittim is a place. Now, if you are biblically literate, very biblically literate, okay, the Shittim should tell you something. Does it ring a bell for anybody? Okay, I'll tell you, okay? We encounter the Shittim in Numbers 25. Numbers 25, verse 1, begins the terrible, terrible story of the nation of Israel that has this terrible sin with Baal Peor, with a Moabite god. It's not only pagan worship, it's pagan worship that's very involved with sexual seduction. It all goes together as part of this pagan worship. And we learn there in chapter 25, verse 1, while Israel was had settled in the Shittim, the nation began to prostitute themselves with the daughters of Moab. Okay, so it's the same place. How do I know it's the same place? First of all, there's no mention of any journeys after Shittim, after this incident of Baal Peor. But I also know from the very end of the book of Numbers, in Numbers 34, verse 49, when we have the whole list of the journeys and the stops of the nation of Israel as they journey through the desert, the final stop in verse 49, and they camped along the Jordan in Beit Yesimot, another place, until as far as Avel HaShittim, along the plains of Moab. Okay, so it's Shittim or Avel HaShittim. It's the same place. Okay, we know that Shittim is in the plains of Moab. We know that it's just on the eastern bank of the Jordan River, and that is where they were. So here we have a situation of Joshua sending spies into the land from Shittim, whereas in the previous story with Baal Peor, the men of Israel go to out from Shittim to engage with the prostitutes of Moab for pagan, terrible, terrible purposes. In here, we have two righteous spies who are sent by Joshua end up in the house of a prostitute. But what a different prostitute. What a different prostitute. They are not looking for prostitutes. They end up in the lodging of a prostitute, and it is such a different person altogether. So I think we see here right away, there's a certain repair or correction that's going on, an opportunity to do it differently as they leave the Shittim. Now, what about this prostitute? Okay, they go and they come to the house of a prostitute. Now you may ask yourself, what are two good men doing visiting the house of a prostitute? Now, it's very clear from the rest of the story that they're not looking for sex. Okay, they're not looking for a prostitute. As for a prostitute, what are they doing there? So we learn a few things as the story continues. And one is that she lives in the wall. Okay, we learn that later on when she makes the deal with the spies, and she says, you know, please save, you know, I am going to protect you now. Please save me and my family. And what is the deal? When they come back to conquer Jericho, she is going to put out a rope, or she actually, even before then, when she actually saves the spies, what does she do? She puts down a rope from the, and this is, I'm looking at verse 15. She let them down by a rope through the window, for her dwelling was at the outer side of the city wall, and she lived in the actual wall. If any of you have ever seen any of the excavations of early Israelite, late Canaanite structures that they've uncovered here in Israel, I'm thinking, for example, of Shiloh. When you go to Shiloh, you can see in the area that they believe is where the original wall was. First of all, you see a very thick stone wall, and then you see a chambers there, and then beyond that, a more wall. So that there were actually houses that would be built into the wall, and the external wall would have been their outside wall. Okay, now why would a prostitute be there? Because she's on the outskirts of society. Prostitutes are always the lowest of the low. These are not the people that are going to be granted, you know, property in the center of town. They will be people who are living in a degree of shame. And so they are at the outskirts. On the other hand, why is it that these spies would have sought to go to that house? Well, one thing, it's a very convenient place to be in the outskirts of the city along the wall. If they're planning an escape route, what better place than to be in the wall? I mean, she actually helps them out the window, but, you know, they could have always jumped out the window and run away from the city. So that certainly would have, I assume, would have been part of their strategy. But also the fact that she's a prostitute, I mean, we all know, I don't know what it's like today, but certainly in those days, you know, very often a prostitute was not only a prostitute, but it might have also been an inn. Think of the old saloons in the American West, okay? Those saloons were a lot of things. They were bars, they were inns, and they were houses of prostitution. And very often this would have been the case. Travelers, people coming here or there, they want a bit of both, a bit of everything. They want a bit of prostitution, they want a bit of lodging, they want a bit of food. And therefore, it's very possible that this house that Rahab was living in, or what her house was this kind of place. It could also have been not just for travelers, but it could have been for people in town. It could have been a place that is a great place to find out what's going on in town. A place that people came in and out at all times, a place to pick up the gossip. Now, if these spies are trying to figure out the lay of the land, they're trying to figure out what the mentality is, how people are thinking, etc., it is a logical place to pick that up. Of course, it's also a place where they can stay, a place where they won't stick out, because it's a place where travelers come and visit. So those are some insights as to what was going on, who was Rahab, and why they chose to go there in the first place. Okay, now we're going to move on to the story. Now it's going to start getting exciting. The king of Jericho was told, "Some men have come here tonight, Israelites, to spy out the country." Okay, they've been caught. The king of Jericho thereupon sent orders to Rahab. "Produce the men who came to you and entered your house, for they have come to spy out the whole country." So clearly these men are spotted as they come into the house, and they've already been suspected of being spies. And so he says to her, you may not know it. I think he gives her the benefit of the doubt. He's saying, you know, you should just know, these are not our friends, they're spies. Therefore, you have to, you know, extradite them. You know, you have to produce them to us. The woman, however, had taken the two men and hidden them. So she already understood that they were in danger. She hid them from the king. She already takes sides. It's amazing. From the very beginning, she takes the side of these men of Israel against her own king. So she says to the king, it is true, she said, the men did come to me, but I didn't know where they were from. Okay. And at dark, when the gate was about to be closed, the men left. And I don't know where the men went. Quick, go after them, for you can overtake them. So she sets up a subterfuge. Okay. She wants the, she not only just says, I don't know. Okay. She actively gets involved in a plan to draw attention away from her house. So she says, you better, you know, they left the gates already. You better go after them. Now she had taken them up to the roof. Now the scene changes. Okay. Now we're going to see what actually happened. You know, she said she had hid them. Well, how did she hide them? This, we get the details here. Now she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under some stalks of flax, which she had lying on the roof. So the men pursued them in the direction of Jordan down to the fords, and no sooner had the pursuers gone out than the gate was shut behind. Okay, so basically, she already hearing that was coming on, the king's men are coming to her, she hides them. The king's men come, she tells them what she tells them, sends them off in the other direction. And the people running out to them, she had basically said, they're already, don't forget, Jericho is right near the Jordan River, and Jericho is a walled city that the gates are shut at night. So these pursuers from the king leave the city, the gates are closed behind them, and they're chasing down to the river, to the Jordan, to find out if that's where they were. Okay? The spies had not yet gone to sleep when she came up to them on the roof. Okay? So she's already deflected them, but she knows the story is not over. And she said to the men, I know that the Lord has given the country to you, because dread of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land are quaking before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Sea of Reeds, Red Sea, for you when you left Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two Amorite kings across the Jordan, whom you doomed. When we heard about it, we lost heart, and no man had any more spirit left because of you. For the Lord your God is the only God in heaven above and on earth below. This is, in my opinion, the reason I love this chapter. It is one of the most amazing declarations of faith on behalf of a Gentile who does not know God, who God has not ever selected. She is not a prophet. She's just an ordinary person. A woman, a Canaanite woman, who takes a look, listens to what's going on, takes a look at what's around her, and of her own initiative comes to recognize God. Now, what does she say here? First of all, she's saying that dread of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land are quaking before you. So she's not only talking about herself. She's actually talking about a response that all of Canaan has to two events that she then mentions, the exodus from Egypt and the defeat of Sihon and Og, the Amorite and the Bashan. Two Amorite kings we learn, remember, in the book of Numbers, okay? Moses is not allowed to go into the land of Canaan, which is defined as west of the Jordan River. But he is involved in the defeat of the kings, the Amorite kings, Og and Sihon, who are on the west, on the eastern side of the Jordan. Okay. And that has already taken place. So both of these things, but they're related. You know, those guys are Canaanites, these guys are Canaanites. I guess the Amorites are Canaanites, whatever. Anyway, they're related. And so this has made an enormous impression. But it's that battle happened a few months earlier. The parting of the Red Sea happened 40 years earlier. So she's talking about both events, both having a powerful impact on the entire area. And yet, of all the people in Canaan who saw and understood and were fearful of God or of whatever as a result of these events, she's the only one who draws the proper conclusion and says, as she does in verse 11, for the Lord your God is the only God in heaven above and on earth below. She is the only one who draws that conclusion. The other words think about it and they say, oh my, oh my. And then they go about their business. They themselves have also heard and witnessed an event that could have been earth-shattering to them, change their faith, change their perspective. She is unique. She is the only one. And I ask myself sometimes, what made her so unique? And again, I think back to the fact that she's a prostitute. She is an outsider, really. She's probably condemned in many ways. She has a family. We learn later she has brothers and sisters and parents, and she is eager to have them saved. And yet she's living on her own, and she's an outcast to a certain degree. And sometimes the fact that you are an outcast, that you're not in the middle of society, gives you a certain freedom of thought. Because if you're part of what everybody else is thinking, very often you don't have the courage or the creativity to sit back and think, now, wait a second, let me take a look at this situation and think about it clearly. She's in that situation. She's already been a bit out of society. She's in the wall, okay? She's on the outskirts. And perhaps that is something, as much as we are not supportive of her profession, it certainly puts her in a position to think differently than the rest of the people. Now, one of the things here, and it always bothers me when I see English translations, not just that they're not accurate, but they, in the way they did the translation, they miss the point, okay? And here is an example. Now, I don't know what the English translation is that you're reading from, but I'd like to point out a very unique word in Hebrew. In verse 9, where it says, the inhabitants of the land are quaking before you. What words do you have for the word quaking? Are there other words that you see there? It's the very end of verse 9. Anybody faint, have other words? Are they all saying
faint
quaking?
Hearted. Yeah. Faint yeah. hearted.
What do you say?
Faint hearted.
Okay. Great. Anyone yeah. else?
That's I have great panicking.
Fear. Meg, what are you saying?
Great fear.
Great fear. Anybody else?
Melting.
Liz, panicking. What are you saying?
Melting in fear.
Melting in fear. That's probably the best translation. Anybody else have something?
I have panicking.
Panicking. Okay. Now, I would like to refer you back to the book of Numbers. One second. Numbers 15, verse 14, verse 15. First of all, let's just look at this one word. Numbers 15, verse 15, okay? The end of that verse, we also talk again about the dwellers of Canaan. Here we have the inhabitants of the land. Here it's the dwellers of Canaan. What is the verb there? In mine, it says the dwellers of Canaan are aghast. What do you have?
What verse was it, Sandra?
Yes, Sandra.
Excuse me, Exodus 15. Exodus 15. Oh, did I say Numbers? That's a mistake.
Yeah,
Exodus 15. Okay, Exodus 15, verse 15. Look at the last line of that verse.
Excellent.
Dwellers of Canaan, it says
melt away.
Terrified.
Melt away. Who said that? You said melt away, Meg? Oh, yes. You said, Liz, you said melt away? Okay. So in Hebrew, it's the very same word, namogu. Namogu, it probably the best way to translate that is melting in fear. Okay? Namogu. Oh. And it is a unique word. It is not a word that's used in other contexts. It's a beautiful word. It's a very literary word. And it's used here in Exodus 15 in the Song of Moses. And it's used in chapter 2 in Joshua. So basically what's happening here, and I want to read again in chapter 2, starting in verse 9. I'm going to read these two verses to you, and then we're going to go back to Exodus 15 and read there and listen to the similarity. First in our chapter, I know that the Lord has given the country to you because dread of you has fallen upon us, and all the inhabitants of the land are melting in fear before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the waters of the Sea of Reeds for you when you left Egypt. Now, let's go back to Exodus 15, starting in verse 14, okay? The peoples hear, they tremble. Agony grips the dwellers in Philistia. Now are the clans of Edom dismayed. The tribes of Moab, trembling grips them. All the dwellers of Canaan melt in fear. Terror and dread descend upon them. Now, all I can say to you is one of my problems that I have with the English translation is that in Hebrew, some of the same words, identical words, are used between Exodus 15 and Joshua 2. And unfortunately, when they translate the same words, not just that word namogu, but these other ones, the ones where they talk about trembling and fear, okay, or trembling grips them, they don't, it's the same word, okay, or their fear falls upon you. They don't say it in the same way in the two English translations. So you kind of don't miss that a bit. But if you're reading in the Hebrew, as you're listening to Rahab, as you're reading what she says to the two spies, you hear right away, she is quoting the Song of Moses. Now, what does that mean? I don't think she heard the Song of Moses, okay? And it's very possible that as the Bible records her words, they adjust her words to make it sound as if she's literally quoting the Song of Moses. But what is it that we are seeing here? What happened during the Exodus? Moses, after the Exodus, exclaiming this amazing miracle, not just of the saving of the nation of Israel from slavery, but this miracle of the parting of the Red Sea, of the fact that all of the nation of Egypt is now drowned with all the army of Egypt is drowned with all their chariots in the waters. And this just amazing, all the miracles that are involved with this Exodus. And his response to that, Moses already is saying, what is the nation's, or what will be the nation's response? They will quake with fear. They will see this happening, okay? And this is what Moses is describing. But when Moses is describing it, he doesn't know it as a fact. He believes it. Maybe God has revealed it to him, but he hasn't seen it because he's saying this song on the shores of the Reed Sea, okay? Or the Red Sea, as we call it today. That's what he has done. And yet here we learn from Rahab, an eyewitness to how the Canaanite nations actually, in fact, responded exactly how Moses said they were. They responded in fear. They responded in awe. They couldn't believe it, okay? And so we see this actual, you know, vision that Moses prescribes about how the world is going to react to it, we see this in Rahab's words. Now, unfortunately, and I think this is a lesson for us today, when amazing things happen, it grips us. It does something to us. And it doesn't matter who you are. And it doesn't matter if you're religious or not. It doesn't matter. When you see something amazing, you are, you can be struck with awe, struck with fear, struck with wonder, okay? And so what Moses says that is that this is what's happening. Yes, and you're right, Kim. It is in the past tense. It happened. But Moses says it. Sometimes you see that in prophetic expression. You express something as something that's already happening, already happened, okay? Even though he's not knowing it, he's being revealed it prophetically, okay? Because think of he doesn't know what the Canaanites are saying, okay? He has no idea. He's there on the shores of the Red Sea, but prophetically, because he knows it is such a fact, that's how he's prescribing it. But Rahab is telling us that this in fact happened. She was there 40 years ago, or she heard it from her family or whatever. We don't know how old Rahab is. Okay, chances are she wasn't even around at that time. I don't know how old or young she is, but she certainly heard about it. But look at how unusual this is. Out of all of Canaan and all of the nations in Philistia and everybody who has this amazing reaction, one woman does something with that awe. One woman preserves that awe in her soul. One woman takes that awe to a place of, yes, I know that it's God who's the master of everything. One woman not only says, yes, I believe in God, and goes back to her living room, but as a result of this, she risks her life to save these two men from Israel because she understands that God is going to be with the nation of Israel. That just like God delivered these kings of Amorite to Israel as they are moving in to conquer the land of Israel, she understands they're about to cross into the land of Israel, and God will deliver them as well. And therefore, she's clever. But how many people are like that? But you could say it's logical. Well, of course, she should have stood with Israel. She was, you know, but all of Canaan could have done that. All of Canaan, as the children of Israel march across the Jordan, all of Canaan could have said, welcome, Israelites. We realize we heard about the Dead Sea. We heard about the war against the Amorites. We realize it all. Welcome. Take the land. It's yours. God is clearly on your side. But they don't do that. One woman does that. And so that is really very, very special. Now, one other thing that I want to point out is the spies. We have we have spies that are sent from the land, from the desert into the land of Israel under Moses 40 years earlier, 38 years earlier. Okay. And that's a very different thing. It's the same word, okay? Meraglim, spies, they go out, they're doing it, but it's a very different mission. Those spies that Moses sends, first of all, they don't come in quietly. They're not really spies. They're more, you know, let's scout out the land, see what's going on. And they're supposed to report back to Moses, how are the people? Remember, Moses says to them, are they in fortified cities? You know, he's trying to figure out, are these people afraid? Are they brave? Are they big? Are they giants? I mean, what's going on there? What kind of challenges are we going to face as we come into the land? Very same questions that these spies are looking for as well, because they're going to come back. And what are they going to say? These spies come back to Joshua, and what they actually say to him, what impresses them more than anything else, with the very last verse of chapter 2, they say to Joshua, the Lord has delivered the whole land into our power. In fact, all of the inhabitants of the land are melting in fear before us. Again, that same word. Three times that word is used. Song of Moses and twice in chapter 2. Okay, so that is clearly the element of Rahab's statement that makes the most impression on the spies, and that's they report to Joshua. So in many ways, they have a similar goal, except that these two spies come in more secretly to discover what people are thinking, and the 12 spies that sent by Moses are much more obvious, okay? But what a difference in their report, okay? Because when the 12 spies come back, 10 of them say the opposite. Who do they say going to be afraid? They say, we're afraid. We're petrified. We're quaking in fear because we saw the giants. It was only Joshua and Caleb, of course, said it differently. No, yes, they're giants, but we can prevail. But these sent by Joshua not just say, God is with us, we can prevail, a whole different message. A message that says the nation is afraid of us. Canaan is afraid of us. What a completely different message and ending of that story. We have not chapter 2. We will continue next week. You can open your mics if you have anything. That's all for this week from my perspective.
That's brilliant.
Anybody?
Thank you.
That's really good, the comparisons. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Okay.
We missed you.
Great having you back. Thank you for your participation.
I love it. You know, there's so much that we miss when we don't read it in the original Hebrew, because, you know, depending on the, even if they do use the same words in English, melt away, dissolve, whatever, none of us would like catch the significance of it, because it's not, you know, that's used in more places, but that it's, the Hebrew word is only used those two places makes it very, very significant. And you know, you really catch that, and we miss it.
Yeah, for good English, you have to be different, don't you? You can't repeat.
Right. Wow.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, great. So we will continue next week with chapter 2. I don't know if
chapter 3.
To chapter
three. You finish,
we'll figure it out. But we're certainly going to.
Can I just say that? Can I just make a comment that Rahab is mentioned as a woman of faith in the New Testament?
Yeah.
And as an ancestor, ancestor of Jesus.
Yeah.
Another. I do want to address, I was going to discuss it next week, but I'll just mention right now, Jewish tradition has Rahab marrying Joshua, and their descendants are not from the house of David. Their descendants are priests and prophets, including Jeremiah and Ezekiel.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a completely different tradition. But we'll talk about that next week.
Silence.
So let's see. So how old was she? How old was she?
Yeah, she'd be a bit younger than Joshua.
Right? Well, she had children, so she couldn't have been too old.
Yeah. True. Well,
Joshua was old. Yeah. Joshua had to have been old.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because Joshua was an adult when he left Egypt. And Caleb was 40. Caleb right. tells us he was 40 when he went out with the spies. Okay. And the assumption is Joshua was around the same age. Joshua was already leading the fight against Amalek when they left right after the Exodus. Okay. It's there, Josh, in chapter, 16 or 17 of Exodus. Right after the Exodus, he leads the fight against Amalek. So he had to have been an adult, not just 20. He probably was 30, 40, whatever. The Jewish tradition has him somewhere in his 30s. Okay. When he leaves. So 40 years later, he's in his late 70s.
Wow. You know,
maybe even 80.
Wow.
Okay. So that's how old he is here.
Okay.
But you know, in biblical times, when you were 80, you just got started. You know, Moses first appeared before Pharaoh when he was 80 years old.
Come on.
He was 120. So 80 is a youngster.
Midlife.
Okay.
Midlife.
Anyway, we'll see y'all next week. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thanks, Sandra.
Goodbye.
Todava ba, Sandra. Shabua tov.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shabua tov.
I hope you enjoyed that video. And we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content. So just click on the subscribe button below, as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.